Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The Donald gets presidential. Hillary spreads the love. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. After yesterday's sweeping primary victories, Trump and Clinton are both acting like they're not just front runners anymore. This morning, Trump delivered his first prepared address on foreign policy.
America first will be the major and overriding theme of my administration.
And Hillary Clinton is focused on holding the Democratic Party together.
There's much more that unites us than divides us.
Bernie Sanders is already talking about influencing the party platform. Ted Cruz and John Kasich still won't concede that the Never Trump movement may never happen. Today's talking point, who was the real Harriet Tubman? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. In the aftermath of yesterday's primaries in five northeastern states, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are both claiming the presidential nominations have been decided. We'll hear what that means for Democrats and Republicans before the conventions as the primaries continue. Today's talking point, slaveholder Andrew Jackson, will be replaced on the $20 bill by Harriet Tubman, the former slave turned abolitionist. But how much do Americans know about her? We'll separate the myths from the reality. First, as news update, Donald Trump talked foreign policy today, hosted by the Center for the National Interest, that's a group formerly known as the Nixon Center. To scattered applause, he repeated attacks on the Obama administration for weakening America's military.
Our military is depleted, and we're asking our generals and military leaders to worry about global warming.
He also repeated a claim familiar to crowds of supporters at campaign events.
I'm the only person running for the presidency who understands this, and this is a serious problem. I'm the only one, believe me, I know them all. I'm the only one that knows how to fix it.
Indira Lakshmanan covered foreign policy and politics for Bloomberg News. She recently wrote The Mystery of Two Hillaries for Politico magazine. We'll talk about two Hillaries in a few moments. But first, Indira Lakshmanan, thanks a lot for being on our program. You were at the speech today.
Absolutely. Just half a block from where I'm sitting right now. And it was striking because Donald Trump was there as the full Donald. He was pugnacious. He was definitely, I'd have to say, after covering a few campaigns, the most confident candidate I have ever seen. Very sure of himself, even if he probably has less foreign policy experience than anyone else who's left on the campaign trail. But he essentially made the point that it's time to shake the dust off of our foreign policy. America First, he said, is going to be the major theme of his administration. I was struck that one of the, you know, the foreign policy establishment was there in the room watching along with several ambassadors who were invited as special guests sitting in the front row. There was the Russian ambassador, there was the Singaporean ambassador, Senator Sessions, and a number of others, including the first congressman to endorse Donald Trump. You know, it was interesting because at the same time, Donald Trump was slagging off, let's be fair, the foreign policy establishment, saying, we need new ideas. He called the Clinton-Obama foreign policy, by which he means Hillary Clinton, not Bill Clinton, a complete and utter disaster, said that the U.S. has no respect anymore in the world, used the simple language for which he's become so popular with his followers, and said he needs new ideas, not the same, you know, hoary old faces of the Washington foreign policy establishment who may look good writing op-eds and being on TV, but he claims to have new ideas. His ideas seem to be essentially retrenchment. We're drowning in debt. We need infrastructure investment, and it's time to focus on America and only on deals that are good for us. Now, one of the foreign policy establishment tweeted out after this that this was the exact rallying cry of the protectionists of the 1930s and the 40s until Pearl Harbor happened.
Did he say anything that was substantially different from what we've been hearing on the campaign trail in a sort of fragmentary way?
No, I think what he did was he took all of those fragments, that he's going to be tough on ISIS, he's going to hit them where they don't know where it's coming from, he's going to only accept deals that are good for the U.S., he's never going to put American workers behind the interests of any other country. He sort of stitched all those little pieces from his stump speeches, which, let's face it, those are not short stump speeches that he gives, so he has plenty of material in there, and kind of laced it together in what was not a short speech either. It was 45 minutes. What struck me is you made the comment that he is turning presidential, but his speech was the same sort of fiery Donald Trump bluster. It did not really make an attempt to, I don't know whether you want to say pander to or speak at the same level as the Washington foreign policy establishment. He was not sort of looking to history other than saying it's great that the Cold War is over, but we haven't had a coherent foreign policy since the end of the Cold War. He was essentially still speaking the same language that he speaks to his followers. I think he's savvy enough to know that, you know, we may have been 200 people in the room in Washington watching, but the audience he cares about are the millions of Americans who are going to watch those clips replayed and replayed on cable television all day. And that's the group to whom he was speaking.
So turning presidential in the sense that he was speaking at the Mayflower Hotel, as you indicated, 200 people, many of them involved in the foreign policy establishment that he denounced, including another attack on the Iraq war, totally against that, he said. It completely destroyed the Middle East. So in that sense, he was being presidential. But in terms of the content of the speech, as you say, he knows who he's talking to.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it was one thing that surprised me. And, you know, in a way, this shouldn't be a surprise because he has said that he wants to focus on America. But he, you know, to this particular crowd, which included some neocons and some people who had supported the Iraq war, he said that aggression will never be his first move, that diplomacy is critical for foreign policy. That's the point where he said that he proudly opposed the Iraq war, which turned out to be a disaster. But then he also said that he wouldn't hesitate to bomb any country that needed to be bombed. But if he's going to deploy military force, it's only going to be when necessary, and it's only going to be to win. So again, using his simple language, saying things are going to be really, really great for the U.S. in any deal with Russia, but then pointedly looking at the front row where the Russian ambassador was sitting, he said, but those deals also have to be good for Russia. So I thought that was interesting. He was at least for one moment aware of someone in his audience.
There's a lot more to talk about in the aftermath of yesterday's primary elections. We're going to hear more from the diplomatic and political correspondent and Indira Lakshmanan, and from others in a moment on To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. We'll talk more today about Donald Trump's speech. But first, here's the broader picture. Yesterday's elections, quote, marked the unofficial end of the 2016 primary season. Barring some unexpected turn of events, the fall matchup for President of the United States will be between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, close quote. That is a rare, very definitive prediction from Amy Walter, who is national editor of the Cook Political Report. Hi, Amy. Good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren.
So it's all over.
It sure feels that way. And I know we do still have some ways to go. And yes, things can still happen. But boy, oh boy, when you look at the numbers that Donald Trump racked up in the Northeast yesterday, it wasn't so much that he won. It's about the margins that he crushed his opponents in states that are supposed to be quote-unquote establishment states. These are the kind of places where John McCain and Mitt Romney, where somebody like Jeb Bush or John Kasich or Marco Rubio, These were the places they were supposed to do well: Maryland, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Connecticut. The fact that he's running as well as he is there should suggest that it is going to be all but impossible to stop him, even as we start to move west into states that are more traditionally red, like Indiana, Montana, South Dakota. But then we end in a state where I think he will do equally well, which is California, and that's the biggest prize. So at the end of the day, Warren, I can see that, you know, look, he may come up a few delegates short. He may not hit the magic 1,237 number that he needs to be the nominee by the end of, June 7th, the end of the primaries officially. But you know what? I just see that he's going to be able to get there before we hit a second ballot.
I think your prediction about California is really interesting. When you say that he won big in Montgomery County, Maryland, affluent suburb of Washington, in Greenwich, Connecticut, and California, of course, is a very blue state. But if he can win in places like that, he can probably win among the very few Republicans that there are in congressional districts in San Francisco and places of that kind, which could mean that he could sweep California in a big way.
Absolutely. I mean, California's a little more complicated because it gives its delegates out by congressional district. But you're exactly right. It doesn't discriminate between really red districts and really blue districts. So you get the same number of delegates winning in a conservative Central Valley district as you do winning in a very liberal Nancy Pelosi San Francisco district.
Amy Walter, again, national editor of the Cook Political Report. We'll be back with you in a moment, as we will as well with Indira Lakshmanan. But first, let me introduce Peter Fever. We want to talk some more about Donald Trump and that speech that he gave this morning. Peter Fever is professor of political science and public policy at Duke University. He has served in both the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. He was on the National Security Council staff. He's also co-editor of the Shadow Government blog at foreignpolicy.com. Good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Do you think that Donald Trump really had anything new to say today? How would you have felt as a member of the foreign policy establishment that we heard described, sitting there in that audience listening to Donald Trump?
Well, this I would have ranked this as his best and his worst foreign policy speech, because it's his first one. What's remarkable is that while he's said all of these lines before, as your previous guest explained, strewn throughout the stump speech, this was the first time he sat down and gave a pre-written speech on foreign policy that had some coherence, some thematic elements to it. We've never had a candidate go this long and get as far as he had without having attempted one. So, you know, you got to give him credit for at least attempting one. But it definitely didn't satisfy his critics and raised as many questions, I think, as he sought to answer. He didn't deal with any of the criticisms that have been levied against him. He just recited some of his lines about foreign policy.
He also contradicted himself in some respects by saying, for example, that he was going to rebuild the military, but also saying there are too many weapons in the world.
Oh, it was riddled with contradictions. As Spencer Ackerman pointed out, Donald Trump said, our allies don't trust us, and our allies are free riding off of us because they trust our guarantees. And he said that Donald Trump says he's going to rebuild the trust. And then he also said he's going to stick it to our allies by demanding more in renegotiations. It was a lot of contradictions. There's also some flat-out falsehoods. He was a supporter of the Iraq War, contrary to his statements. He was initially supported the Iraq War, and then he opposed it afterwards, and then, of course, opposed the Iraq surge. But his position on the Iraq War was a lot closer to Hillary Clinton's than he claims in the speech.
He did talk, as was pointed out earlier, about the Obama-Clinton administration, or sometimes the Clinton-Obama administration. So clearly he wants to be running against the former Secretary of State.
Right, and let's be fair. Not everything he said in the speech was wrong. He repeated a criticism of the Iran nuclear deal, for instance, that many others, including myself, have made, which is that the administration gave the impression that it would not walk away from the table, and as a result, Iran did not make as many concessions as they might have if the United States had been one to walk away. Trump developed that theme in his speech. I think that's a fair criticism. I've actually heard folks inside the administration quietly acknowledge there's something to it. So it's not as if every word in the speech or every line in the speech was wrong, but I don't think it answered or I don't think it satisfied critics who worry about his command of foreign policy.
Did it make a coherent case, incoherent in some respects and contradictory, but did it make a coherent case against Hillary Clinton?
No. And one of the ironies is that while Hillary Clinton has an impressive resume, she actually has lots of vulnerabilities on foreign policy. But Donald Trump's probably the Republican candidate least positioned, least qualified to take her on those terms. So he basically left her unscathed on foreign policy. And he also opened himself up, you know, gave her actually a great entree. If there's a theme to this, it's America First. That's if you go to the website and download the speech, they have that phrase capitalized. That's what the Donald Trump's handlers want you to remember from the speech. Well, of course, America First was the name of the organization in the 1930s, arguing to keep the United States out of World War II. Don't fight the Nazis. We don't have any dog in that fight. And it was a disastrous policy of isolationism that America paid a terrible price for. And that's the label that he's embraced for his own foreign policy. It's really quite ironic.
Peter Feaver, once again, formerly on the National Security Council staffs of both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, and now at Duke University. Amy Walter, back to you with the Cook Political Report. Today, Jennifer Rubin, the Washington Post blogger, conservative writer, has written that many Republicans are seriously considering voting for a Democrat for the first time in their lives. Do you agree with that? Do you think that's a safe prediction to make?
Listen, I think we are going to see a very interesting period right now for the Republican Party, a party that has been at war with itself for many years. This didn't start with Donald Trump, but in which I think the party, many party regulars who are upset with the way in which the party has been dealing both with policy as well as strategy, it's been somewhat muted, and they've still sort of sucked it up and voted for the team player, whether that was Mitt Romney or John McCain or the leadership in Congress. Now I think you're going to see something of an all-out revolt. I don't know how big it's going to be. I do think that at the end of the day, more Republicans come about than don't. But if you look at the data that we see right now in national polling, what you find is that there's about 35-36% of Republicans who say they would be dissatisfied if Donald Trump were the nominee. 27% say they'd be very dissatisfied. So I think it's a safe bet to say there's about a quarter of the Republican electorate right now that is sitting there thinking, I cannot vote for Donald Trump. Maybe they vote for Hillary Clinton. Maybe they stay home. Maybe they write in somebody's name. But getting those people back is going to be tough. And when you see where he's losing voters, are doing poorly with voters in a general election. You know, he has unfavorable ratings with women at 75%, with African Americans at 91%, with Latinos at 81%. These aren't all Democrats. So his challenge is both to convince the sort of Kasich-type voters that are very wary of him to come on board, as well as some of the very conservative Republicans who disagree, like when you listen to his speech today, whether on foreign policy or whether you listen to his pronouncements on some other social issues or fiscal issues. If you listen to Ted Cruz last night, his scathing attacks on Donald Trump's record, it's going to be hard to see how this party comes fully back together again.
You mentioned women. Here's something that Donald Trump had to say last night, talking about, of course, once again, Hillary Clinton.
Frankly, if Hillary Clinton were a man, I don't think she'd get 5% of the vote. The only thing she's got going is the woman's card. And the beautiful thing is, women don't like her, okay? And look how well I did with women tonight. Okay.
I want to go back to Indira Laxmanan. Earlier, we heard her talking about the real audience that Trump was talking to today, even though there were 200 foreign policy types in the Mayflower Hotel in the same room with him. How do you think that kind of a comment is going to go down if he continues it?
Look, I mean, I think that we just saw what Ted Cruz has done just in the last few minutes while we've been speaking. He's chosen Carly Fiorina as his vice presidential running mate. That's the big announcement he's going to make today. So clearly other people like Ted Cruz are trying to, whether you want to call it pander to the women's vote or appeal to the women's vote. I think we all saw that it's now been made a GIF. It's so popular, that video of Governor Chris Christie's wife sitting right behind Donald Trump when he made that comment, claiming that Hillary would have, you know, no votes if she weren't a woman. And you see Mrs. Christie, the first lady of New Jersey, whose husband has, of course, endorsed Donald Trump, kind of rolling her eyes and looking kind of uncomfortable to be there. As that's become a meme on the internet. I don't, you know, if the wife of someone who's endorsed Trump is unhappy about him saying that, playing the woman card in that way, I don't think it's going to go over really well with others. On the other hand, Trump's base is his solid base. Those are his supporters. They've already heard him say everything insulting about women, about Muslims, about Mexicans. They've heard it all. So this is not going to turn them off, him saying this. We're talking about the 70% of the people who in the polls have already unfavorable feelings about Trump. This may magnify those feelings, but the 30% who feel favorably or at least not unfavorably about him, I'm not sure that this is going to change them. I want to just go back to something that Amy said about whether the Republicans are going to, you know, suck their teeth, as John McCain's mother said back in 2008, and finally support him. In this case, it would be supporting Donald Trump. And after the Donald Trump speech, I spoke to Bud McFarland, who was the national security advisor to President Reagan in the early mid-1980s, and asked him, really tried to nail him down, okay, you heard the speech, what did you think? He said, well, he didn't have any specifics. You know, he made some good points, but he didn't have any specifics of how he's going to get there. Okay, so are you going to vote for him if he's the nominee? And Bud McFarland looked very uncomfortable and said, gosh, you know, I was really wishing that John Kasich would get the nomination, but, and he was unwilling to say whether he would ultimately, you know, suck his teeth and support him. So I think that's still an unknown.
Peter Fever, back to you. You've been in both Democrat and Republican administrations. You are, however, as I understand it, a Republican. Where do you come down?
Well, I think she's right that there is a debate and that there are many Republicans who say they just won't vote for Donald Trump. I had one today, one prominent Republican, tell me that he was torn between publicly endorsing Clinton and privately, quietly voting for her. So I do think there will be a significant fraction of the party that won't support him. I think there could be a fraction that will look for a third party opportunity. And I think most of the people in this category are still hoping that he falls short of 1237 and there's a brokered convention. I don't think they're yet ready to give up on that, although
very quickly, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We've just got seconds left, but do you think by choosing Carly Fiorina as a running mate, Ted Cruz made it any more likely that he's going to get more votes and be able to be a challenger at the convention?
I think he has seized a little bit of the news cycle away from Trump, and that will help him. But it's going to come down to Indiana for Cruz. He has to win in Indiana.
And it's unclear to what extent John Kasich will endorse him there, as had apparently been agreed to, but then Kasich kind of stepped away.
Right. That's the problem all along, has been that the other candidates, the non-Trump candidates, have not been able to coordinate, and that has helped Trump throughout, starting in last September.
Okay. Well, Peter Fever, thanks a lot for being with us again at Duke University, formerly with both the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations, with the National Security Staff, and now co-editor of Shadow Government, the blog at foreignpolicy.com. We're going to talk about the Democrats when we get through on our talking point later, when we get through with a very brief break. On our talking point later, who was the real Harriet Tubman? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
We're Warren Ollie back with To The Point. Last night it was election results from the northeastern states where Trump and Clinton both swept, although in Clinton's case not completely. This morning, Donald Trump seized the news cycle by making a foreign policy speech. Now Ted Cruz is trying to get it back, as we just heard pointed out, by saying that Carly Fiorina is going to be his running mate if, in fact, he is nominated as the Republican candidate for president. There's that other party, though, and once again, Hillary Clinton swept all of the states that were up except for Rhode Island, which was won by Bernie Sanders. And here's a bit of what Bernie Sanders had to say.
It is incumbent upon Secretary Clinton to reach out not only to my supporters, but to all of the American people with an agenda that they believe will represent the interest of working families, lower income people, the middle class, those of us who are concerned about the environment and not just big money interests.
Paul Waldman is a blogger at The Washington Post. He's a columnist for The Week, and he is senior writer at The American Prospect, which is a liberal magazine. Paul Waldman, good to have you on our program. Is what we just heard essentially a concession by Bernie Sanders when he's saying it's now time for Senator Clinton to reach out, not just to his supporters, but to others as well? Paul Waldman, you with us? Well, for some reason, we are not able to get in touch with Paul Waldman. He was on Skype, and we thought he was available, but not for the moment, apparently. So let me go back to Amy Walter again, our national editor from the Cook Political Report. What do you think about that? Is Sanders, even though he's promised to stay on through the convention, really conceded?
I mean, it feels as if what he's decided to do is to say that he is now moving his focus to, I'm going to be the nominee, to I'm going to be driving the agenda of the next nominee. And that's kind of where he started this race. I mean, if you remember when we first started watching Bernie Sanders on the debate stage, when he famously said he didn't want to talk about Hillary Clinton's damn emails, what we concluded then, or at least I concluded then, was that this was a candidate who was much more interesting in pushing his agenda and having a battle of ideas than in battling Hillary Clinton for the nomination. I think you saw that battle, though, take a different turn over the last few weeks, where he started to see himself as a potential nominee when he started to pick up states and win a lot bunch of delegates. Now we're back to where we were at the beginning, where mathematically he is really out of a contention and an ability to win this nomination fight, but that doesn't mean he has to completely abandon the stage. The real question in my mind is how and when he embraces Hillary Clinton as the nominee. You're right, he doesn't need to do it now. He can wait until after this nomination fight is over, till after the primaries end. But convincing his followers, those who believe that he has created a revolution, is to support Hillary Clinton, to convince them that, you know, this person that he's said over and over again is sort of a shill for Wall Street, isn't standing up enough to the corporate culture as part of the establishment. That is going to be a tough challenge, and will his followers will he do it, number one, and number two, will his followers believe it? Uniting the Democratic Party is not going to be as difficult as uniting the Republican Party, but it is not going to be a cakewalk, and there is a real generational divide as well as a divide between independents and Democrats and somewhat among men and women about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party that's going to need to heal as we move forward and if Hillary Clinton's going to be successful.
We're now in touch with Paul Waldman, who is a blogger at The Washington Post and a columnist for The Week, as well as senior writer at The American Prospect liberal magazine. And, Paul, good to have you on our show.
Thank you. Sorry for the technical difficulties.
No problem. Don't worry about it. Not your fault. What about the prospect for particularly the young voters and people who haven't been involved in the system at all before, who have come out in favor of Bernie Sanders, apparently gave him the idea that maybe he could pull it off after all, and then he wouldn't be just influencing the platform. What are the prospects, do you think, that they will, in fact, go with Hillary Clinton? Will Bernie Sanders have to persuade them?
Well, I think that they will end up coming around. You know, we usually see this, that we're at a time right now when emotions are really high. They're feeling terribly disappointed. And when they look at Hillary Clinton, at the moment, they see somebody who they contrast with the person that they wanted, Bernie Sanders. But in a few months from now, when they look at her, they're going to see a contrast with Donald Trump. And we also have to ask what exactly it is that we're wondering whether they're going to do. You know, is it just, are they going to turn out to vote? Because that may be enough. Or is it that we expect them to, you know, go out to rallies and donate money and knock on doors? And you know, they're probably not going to do that to the extent that they were for Bernie Sanders, or at least the people who did it for Bernie Sanders aren't going to do it to the same extent for Hillary Clinton. But, you know, she may not need that much from them. She doesn't need that same kind of level of fervent devotion that Sanders got. All she needs really is for them to get out and vote. And I think that once the race changes that context, where Trump is the contrast, you know, we're going to see them come around in the same way that we saw Clinton's voters come around 8 years ago when they said that they weren't going to support Obama in the general election.
Are you then conceding that you think it is over, that in fact Hillary Clinton has won it?
Oh, I think so. I mean, it may not be mathematically impossible for Sanders to win at the moment, but he'd have to basically sweep her by huge margins in every single primary coming up. And I don't think there's anyone who thinks that's going to happen. And you can tell, listening to him, that even if he hasn't given up yet, he's kind of trying to figure out how he can sort of get through this period and find the place for himself. And that's a big question for him. And I think that matters for his supporters, too, is if the Sanders campaign was important to you, then what do you want out of it going forward? You know, how can he and his supporters maximize the influence they have over the Democratic Party, over Hillary Clinton if she becomes president? And, you know, one of the points that I've made is that her sort of ideological malleability, where she sometimes will move to adjust herself to where her party is, the Sanders campaign and Sanders' supporters, even if they didn't like that about her, they could see that as an advantage, because that means that she is open to being influenced, to being persuaded, to being pressured. And if they can pull her to the left, then she may, you know, produce policies as a president that they'll like more than what they might have thought that she would do beforehand. And so they need to, in order to produce that, they need to stay involved and actually exert that pressure on her.
Let me go back to Indira Lakshmanan, the guest from our first half of our program. Again, covered foreign policy and politics for Bloomberg News, traveled with both Secretaries of State Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, and now has written for Politico magazine, The Mystery of the Two Hillaries. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is something that Hillary herself admitted to in a recent debate when she was asked why many Americans didn't like her or didn't trust her. And her answer was, in part, I'm not a natural politician, in case you haven't noticed. And, you know, which is completely self-evident, but for her to embrace it and own it. And later she added in a town hall that, look, you know, I'm much better when I'm actually in the job and have a job to do than when I'm fighting and trying to get the job. And I thought about that, and it is completely true. And I was the only beat reporter who covered her both in the 2008 campaign and then went over to the State Department to cover her and travel with her for the next 4 years. And what I said in the Politico magazine piece, and I really believe is true, is it was like covering two completely different people. I was, you know, from the very first trip she took as Secretary of State, she came to the back of the plane to talk with the press for the first time. She had, you know, rarely spoken to the press in the entire 2007-2008 campaign. And I was sort of struck by this invasion of the body snatcher sensation that here was this woman who was suddenly warm and friendly and smart and seemed to really know her stuff and seemed to be comfortable and got out there everywhere we went overseas and charmed the crowds. You know, whether it was in a slum in Jakarta where thousands and thousands of people thronged the slum to see her walking into a maternal health clinic. It was as if we were traveling with Beyonce or something, you know, and one of her security guards privately said to me, gee, you know, if she'd gotten this kind of reception back in Iowa, the election might have turned out a little bit differently. But, you know, it was striking to watch her sort of come into her own with these political skills that she simply either didn't have or didn't know how to use them on the campaign trail with American voters, at least not on the stage engage, not in the way we expect politicians to speak to us and electrify us in the way that President Obama obviously electrified so many American voters in 08 and in 12. But Hillary was somehow able to do this when she was overseas, was able to have foreign audiences eating out of the palm of her hand, and even in very strange situations like an unannounced trip that she made to Libya right after the ouster of Colonel Gaddafi. And as we were going back to her plane on the tarmac, she was suddenly swarmed by this really terrifying horde of Libyan rebels with bazookas and bandanas who had been our supposed security guards during this trip. And they went, you know, surging for her, and I and the other press and her aides were all kind of watching. What they wanted was selfies with her. They all wanted to stand around her and, you know, give the V for victory sign. And she very gamely stood there and smiled with them and took the selfies. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, she was much more of a politician overseas and much more comfortable in herself as a policymaker than she has been on the campaign trail. So I think the big question for November will be, is she able to inhabit the body of the real Hillary and show Americans who she really is when she doesn't feel as much under siege? But I think she is going to be under siege no matter who the Republican candidate is. And Donald Trump, let's face it, is essentially her photo negative. He's everything she's not. He's not the policy wonk. He's the sort of, you know, electrifying reality TV, unfiltered, raw personality, which is definitely not what she is.
Let me go back to Paul Waldman with the American Prospect. What do you anticipate then when we see them together? Of course, there will be debates, one presumes, and they'll be on the stage at the same time. Even when they're not, of course, they'll be constantly contrasted, and perhaps we'll see double screen images of them, particularly if they are as different sounding as the idea of a mirror image would suggest.
Yeah, it's going to be one of the most fascinating contrasts I think we've ever seen in a presidential election. And they're so different in every way. You know, Hillary Clinton is the candidate who's always super prepared, who knows the details of every issue, and Donald Trump is the one who doesn't even seem to care about the details. It's not just that he's ignorant. It's that he doesn't even think it's important to know how policy works or how government works. I think that it's going to be just so striking. And one question I think that's going to be important for him is he going to be able to have an awareness of when things aren't working for him? You know, he's had this sort of flying by the seat of his pants campaign, and the remarkable thing is that it has worked. You know, he didn't really have anything resembling a genuine campaign structure, but yet he somehow managed through this succession of rallies and getting all of the media coverage in the world to keep winning and winning and winning until he had the nomination all but wrapped up. But what happens when things aren't actually going well and his aides come to him and say, you know, we have a real problem, we're losing? Is he going to say, oh, those polls don't matter? Or is he going to say, well, I have to change something, I have to adapt? Because, you know, right now, somewhere between 65 and 70% of the American public has an unfavorable opinion of him. He's won because he managed to assemble a plurality of a minority. But the majority of the whole country doesn't seem to like him very much.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want just to play for our listeners something that I think is really quite interesting. We talked earlier about Donald Trump attacking Hillary Clinton for what he referred to as the woman card and how well that might or might not go down. She's done a commercial. We can't show you the whole thing because a lot of it depends on the visuals rather than the audio. But here's just a little bit of that commercial.
This is my daughter, Nova. My granddaughter, Ava, they were killed 7 years ago.
It's a domestic.
Oh, bless your heart.
Oh, my gosh.
So there she is with somebody's granddaughter. Amy Walter, back to you with the Cook Political Report. Is she going to be able, do you think, through television, to create an image that's going to be attractive to people, even though she may herself not be able to pull it off, as we just heard, in a situation where she's under stress?
Well, Warren, this is where we're in really uncharted territory before. Not only is it that we have a reality TV show star as a Republican nominee, but we have, in the matchup between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, two of the most disliked people facing against each other that we've seen in modern American history. We've never had two candidates with disapproval ratings this high face each other in a general election. So both candidates are going in with serious negatives, with serious liabilities. The biggest benefit for Hillary Clinton right now is that his are just so much higher than hers. But if this were just Hillary Clinton versus a generic Republican, she would be in serious, serious trouble, and we would be talking about the uphill battle she was facing in order to win this fight.
Well, let me go back to Paul Waldman. You have reported on this and the idea that she has pivoted in terms of this image issue. How do you think that's going to work?
Well, she has, much in contrast to the way she ran in 2008, really embraced the idea that she is a woman candidate who is going to appeal in particular ways to women. And, you know, we saw it just yesterday where Trump accused her of playing the woman card. And she said something like, if that's, you know, if what I'm doing is playing the woman card, then deal me in. I think that this is probably going to, this election will see, I think, the largest gender gap we've ever seen before, because Trump is so antagonistic toward women in so many ways, and he doesn't even seem to realize that he's doing it. And that's what's so remarkable, I think. That, you know, you see him say these things like that, and you can almost see him in his own head just thinking to himself, yeah, I'm killing it. But what he's doing is pushing women away every single time. You know, when he says that he can't stand the sound of her shouting, and when he talks about, you know, playing the woman card in this way, and when he attacks women for their looks, he doesn't even understand how what kind of negative reaction women have to that. And so, meanwhile, Hillary Clinton, I think, is going to be trying to bait him into doing that as often as he can, and he is going to take the bait every time because that's just who he is, and he doesn't get that he's pushing women voters away again and again and again. And so I think the gender gap is just going to be enormous this year.
So, Indira Lakshmanan, maybe then gender will be something she has going for her, whether she's skillful at exploiting it directly or not.
Look, she certainly has it with women voters, particularly older women voters, maybe not with some of the college students who are supporting Bernie. But, you know, as we were talking about earlier, I think likely in November, those, you know, Bernie bros, she'll have to figure out some way to get them into her camp. And we certainly know there are going to be some Republicans who, even if they don't outright cast a vote for Hillary, they might stay home and just not vote for Trump. I mean, Trump is going to attack her in every way he can, whether it's as a woman, whether it's as an incompetent. Today, he attacked her during his speech by saying that she lied on Benghazi. And as we know, Benghazi is one of those dog whistle code words that opponents to Hillary Clinton, you know, makes them wake up and, you know, their eyes get big. And he said she talked about that 3 a.m. phone call, but she wasn't awake for that 3 a.m. phone call. I mean, you know, some of what he's saying is not factually accurate, but it doesn't really matter, again, to his base. So, you know, she'll get attacked on all fronts for that. But the Carly Fiorina choice, you know, Paul was just referring to Donald Trump making offensive comments about women's looks. We're talking about Carly Fiorina, the former presidential candidate. Now she's going to be Ted Cruz's purported running mate. I think that Ted Cruz is trying to bank on the women's vote on the Republican side to give him a boost. And he's thinking that this may help him in a brokered convention try to get ahead of Trump. And okay, we'll see. I don't think it could hurt him.
All right. Thank you all very much for the moment. We'll have you all back as we continue to talk about the campaign as it goes on and gets more dramatic every day. Indira Lakshmanan, once again, The Mystery of the Two Hillaries for Politico Magazine, a former reporter for Bloomberg News. Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report. Paul Waldman at the Washington Post and the American Prospect. And our earlier guest, Peter Fever, now at Duke University. Great to have you all, and come back, join us again. In a moment, Harriet Tubman, the myths and the realities on today's Talking Point.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
Norman Allen here with today's Talking Point. Susan B. Anthony was the first woman on an American $1 coin. Harriet Tubman will be the first African-American to appear on American currency. Her face will replace Andrew Jackson's on the $20 bill. Well, who is Harriet Tubman, and Who is she not? Kate Clifford Larson is reporter, is author of Bound for the Promised Land, Harriet Tubman, Portrait of an American Hero. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You found it necessary to dispel mythology about Harriet Tubman. So let's begin there. What are some of the well-known myths about her that need to be explored?
One of the most famous myths is that she rescued 300 people in 19 trips during her years while operating on the Underground Railroad. And while that's a great, story, the truth is that she actually personally rescued about 70 family members and friends and then gave instructions to about 70 more who found their way to freedom independently. Now, this is still a remarkable feat because nobody did this during that time. Someone might go back and rescue a wife or a child, but nobody repeatedly went back into slave territory to bring people away like Tubman did. So it's important for people to understand that and to recognize the difficulty of going back and doing what she did. It really was remarkable.
As another example of how things get exaggerated, there was also a story that there was a $40,000 reward for her capture. That would have been big money.
That would have been probably like $1 million back then. That didn't happen. The only reward for her was $100 for her capture. If it had been $40,000 reward, we'd know about it. It would be published in newspapers across the country. There was no such thing. And she would have been captured for that kind of money, especially when you could buy a farm for about $400. She would have been betrayed. So that just got exaggerated after the Civil War when people were trying to draw attention to her accomplishments. And, they just made these things up. And it's sort of sad, but a testament to how much they wanted Tubman to be recognized for her work.
Was there anybody in particular who was very eager to see that kind of recognition and consequently was responsible for some of the myths?
Well, there were a lot of former abolitionists that really wanted her to get credit for the things that she had done. But one of her early biographers, Sarah Bradford, who was a Victorian children's book author, took on the project of writing a short biography of Tubman so that they could sell it and raise money for her. And she was prone to making things up and exaggerating. And also, I think she had difficulty understanding Tubman. And also, she wasn't sure she should believe everything Tubman told her, which is deeply unfortunate because Tubman didn't tell lies. She just told the truth of what happened.
Sometimes she's portrayed as a sort of a grandma-like figure.
Yes, this is sort of a tragedy because during her Underground Railroad years, she was a young woman. She escaped when she was 27 years old. So her late 20s and into her 30s, she was operating on the Underground Railroad. So she was a young woman. But most people portray her as this old, arthritic, kind of bent over, cranky old woman, and that's not really Tubman in her prime.
You describe her as fierce.
Oh, she was fierce. Can you imagine that type of person who would defy all the dangers and the threats to her life to return into, slave territory in order to rescue her family members? Her life was on the line all the time, and she wouldn't take no for an answer. And then she went on to become a soldier and a spy during the Civil War. A petite, 5-foot-tall African-American woman as a spy and a soldier. I mean, it's remarkable. She was fierce, and she knew she had to be to overturn slavery.
Spy for the Union Army.
She did. She spied for the Union Army, and she was incredibly effective, and she was deeply respected by Union officers. She had a large following of people who admired her.
How did you come to be a biographer of Harriet Tubman, and what did you find that you haven't already been able to tell us as you did that work?
I fell deeply in love with her back in the 1990s when I decided to go back to school and get my degree in women's history, and I discovered that no one had written a biography of her in about 50, 60 years, which was shocking to me at the time. And while doing my research, there was so much that had not been tapped into, so many primary sources in the North and in the South that really opened up the story of who Harriet Tubman really is. And she was a warrior. She battled slavery. She had a family that she loved deeply, and that's why she went back to rescue people, because of who she loved, and she wanted them to be free just like she was. And she was a remarkable woman in that she would not stop until, you know, she could find that freedom and bring it to everybody. And she fought for equality and justice and self-determination. Her life is just an incredible story of, you know, a real American patriot.
I understand that she complained when she was a spy for the Union Army because she wasn't getting equal pay.
That's right. She was paid a little bit of money to be a spy, but she petitioned the U.S. government for decades to pay her what she thought she was due, because men were paid a lot more than she was, and they did not pay her what she was owed. And so she really was very angry about that.
What's your take on the reaction so far to removing Andrew Jackson, who, of course, was a slave owner, and putting her in his place on the $20 bill?
Well, I think it's brilliant, and I think it's appropriate, and I think that half our currency should have women on it, and Tubman is a perfect choice to be on the 20. And Andrew Jackson probably was not a great choice to begin with, since he wasn't really in favor of the paper currency and our banking system, but also it's time to let go of some of those slaveholders and people who had done some horrific things to expand our landscape here as a nation and to bring forth people who, you know, where we haven't traditionally recognized or memorialized.
Do you think this will work to make Harriet Tubman a role model for other very particularly African-American women?
I hope she's a role model for all of us, because if anybody was a true freedom fighter and an American patriot, it's Harriet Tubman, and we should all try to model ourselves after Harriet Tubman.
Okay, and how soon will it be before we start seeing her on the $20 bill?
I don't know. That's the big question. The design is supposed to be ready in 2020. Of course, we're all hoping that that means the currency will be coming out of our ATM machines at the same time. Let's hope that it's by then, the latest.
Kate Clifford Larson, the author of Bound for the Promised Land, Harriet Tubman, Portrait of an American Hero. A very interesting book. Thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.